companies want to migrate to the cloud, but they don't really think about these problems beforehand, which means that they either have to restrict a lot of access, which is frustrating development teams, and also not really increasing development velocity, or you are basically opening everything up to everybody, which will, well, usually lead to happy developers because they are free to work on whatever they want to work on. But it's also really, really risky because you have to rethink what the risks are that you currently have. And what does it mean when the laptop of one of your developers gets compromised by malware, for example? Can that really bring your whole company to its knees? So these are very interesting challenges to think about. And I usually see that companies do this way too late. They start migrating, they have everything in the cloud, and then they start thinking about what does this mean for our security posture.
Welcome to the All Things Ops podcast. On this show, we interview leaders in IT operations, DevOps, and AI ops about the ever-changing world of running an organization's technology. With our guests, we dive into things like, what does it mean to run large-scale IT infrastructures? How do you manage globally distributed operations? What are the complexities of hybrid IT? How can you best leverage automation? And last, but definitely not least, how do you keep an eye on things using monitoring and observability? This podcast is produced by Tribe29, the company behind CheckMK, the software of choice when it comes to monitoring hybrid IT infrastructures. I'm Elias Volker, and I will be your host today.
Welcome, everybody. My guest today is Laurens Baartman. Laurens is an aerospace engineer from the Netherlands who has been working both on the offensive and on the defensive side of IT security for a whole number of years. And we're going to talk about that later. He is currently the director of technology for Xabia North America, where but prior to that, he has worked as an offensive security specialist, as a CISO, and as an IT security consultant. Laurens, welcome to the All Things Ops podcast. It's great to have you.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here, and thank you for the introduction.
All right, let's get started. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You were an ethical hacker and have had various roles in IT security. Give us sort of the 30-second elevator pitch of who you are and how you got where you are today.
Ooh, 30 seconds is going to be tight, but I'll do my best.
Well, you can make it 1 minute. That's fine as well.
All right. Great. So yeah, I started my career as an hacker, ethical hacker, and in software engineering. That's actually where I got most of my hard technical skills from. And I had the pleasure to work with some of the best hackers in the world, literally. I was trained by a hacker called Daan Keuper, who is a 4-time Pwn to Own winner, which is quite famous in the hacking scene. So I was very lucky to have these people around me and learn a lot from them about software security, web application development, and infrastructure. Did it for several years, but after that, I grew into a CISO position, which was nice, but a lot of regulatory and compliance or regulation and compliance that I had to deal with, which was less nice. I wanted to be more involved in engineering. So that's also when I decided I wanted to broaden my horizon and look for something different. This is when I started with Xabia, first off as an IT security consultant. So I basically helped companies defend against the hacker that I used to be. And this was very interesting, building a fortress, helping teams defend themselves against attackers, and also identifying which attackers that could be for each company. So that's also when you get more in touch with cloud engineering, because most companies are either in the cloud or moving to the cloud. So a lot of cloud security engineering there as well, which was relatively new to me. If you come from the world of ethical hacking, cloud security is kind of a new topic. So I learned a lot about cloud engineering, got certified in Google Cloud in particular. And this is also when I merged these two disciplines, become a cloud security engineer, if you will. And eventually, I liked it so much that I wanted to be more of an entrepreneur in this scene. And the CEO of Xebia Cloud in the Netherlands asked me to help him set up his business in the US. So here I am as a director of technology for Xebia Cloud US. I also said I'm not a sales guy. I'm not a, I don't have the ambition to work in sales. As it turns out, when you get in the position that I'm in right now, sales is inevitable. So I am still in a sales team for some reason, but it's actually really, really nice. But of course, I have a commercial counterpart that is helping me out with everything on the commercial side and the sales side as well. So I can focus on the technology. And this is where we are today.
Okay, great. So tell us a bit what Xebia does. You don't only do security. I think you have a much broader scope in terms of IT advisory, cloud transformation, these topics, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So Xebia is currently over 6,000 people worldwide. But it started out as a, as we call it, a high-end consultancy firm in the Netherlands. And we like to be seen as an authority in the field. So we have all these specialized business units that act as if they, that basically want to be seen as an authority in the field in their respective disciplines. So we have teams that focus on digital transformations, a team that focuses on IT security, software development, cloud engineering, data science, software quality, and many more. And these are all, well, basically standalone companies, which is really nice because that means that they can really develop their expertise and become an authority in the field while having the resources of a very large company, being as Xebia is. And so Xebia has evolved into a bigger company over the years. So in the Netherlands, I think they grew organically to 2,000 or 3,000 people. And Xebia is now also currently in a buy and build strategy, which means that we are expanding globally by acquiring other companies that fit the culture of Xebia. And that culture is really based on four principles, which are people first, because if you want to have a high-end consultancy company, the people are the most important assets. So really people come first at Xebia. Sharing knowledge, because we think it's very important to keep up to date with everything that's going on in the market. So that's a very important value for us. Every 2 weeks, we gather with the whole company with dinner and drinks, and we have knowledge sharing sessions in the afternoon and the evening to help each other out with challenges that we encounter with clients, or also challenges that you encounter in life, right? I mean, being a consultant is more than just working for clients. You also have a life. And you try to combine what you do with what you like to do in your private time. So
I obviously have been in the wrong consultancy, because when I was back in consulting, I didn't have a life. But hey, maybe that's why I got out of it. Yeah.
So that's something that a lot of people recognize when working in consultancy. So yeah, we have a lot of attention for that as well, to make sure that people have a balanced life and that they can help each other out with the challenges that they face, especially when you're starting a family, for example. Customer intimacy. We really like to be involved in what our clients are doing and really deliver business value. So we like to have a good relationship with our clients and being able to help them out wherever we can to the best of our abilities. And quality without compromise. We really want to deliver solutions that are high quality and that we don't have to compromise on. We tend to actually turn down an assignment if we cannot deliver quality without compromise, because that's not what we're in the game for. And I think these values also make Xebia a great place to work, being a consultant. And that's what we stand for globally.
All right, good. So that was your little come work for us pitch, which obviously is totally, totally legitimate. I know that the people in our field, in your field, are very hard to come by. So you're growing. I saw sort of some of the stuff that you put out. Totally get that. So the two of us, we get in touch because I actually talked to a colleague of yours, which I think is your commercial counterpart for North America, about an ebook that I found that Xebia published about sort of six strategies for cloud transformation. And I read through this, found it interesting. And you you or your marketing team or whoever named this very aptly, these six strategies: rehosting, replatforming, re-architecting, repurchasing, retiring, and retaining. So these are the six strategies, and obviously we're not going to go through all of these six in detail, but can you just very briefly talk us through what these six mean from an organization's perspective, how you look at them, also from maybe more with a technical eye on things, and if you talk to clients, what you're encountering there?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so these are basically technical strategies for a cloud transformation. When you want to move your application that's running on-premise to the cloud, you have a couple of challenges that you have to overcome, and they are basically captured in these six items. So yeah, starting with the rehosting, it's nothing more or less than just changing the infrastructure hosting provider, right? That's basically similar when you move from data center to data center or from data center to cloud. It's basically lifting your application to the cloud and not changing anything except for the infrastructure service provider. It's the most basic thing you can do, but it's also not delivering the value that you can get out of cloud. So it's quite limited. And in general, it's not something to be advised unless circumstances really need this. So then we move down to replatforming. And this is where we are changing the infrastructure to some extent to actually support your workload and to make use of what cloud in this case can actually offer you. So for example, when you move from a on-premise data center that's located in a specific city and you move to, say, Google Cloud, then suddenly you are in a network that's global. So what you're doing fundamentally changes. You can actually use these features of the cloud to your benefit. Suddenly you have global presence with your application. You have different kinds of load balancers. You can change the way you do firewalling, or you can separate certain network segments. So this is what replatforming is about. You're rethinking the actual infrastructure platform that your application runs on, which is, of course, a step in the right direction. And then we come to re-architecting, which might sound a little bit similar, but re-architecting is really thinking about how your application works. So this is more, stepping from the infrastructure layer to the application layer. And then you are rethinking how this application should work logically. So, of course, software development comes in here, but you have to think about how it should work from a business perspective, usually. This is where you see big monolithic applications being split up in microservices, for example. That's what re-architecting is about. And then you can actually use a lot of the cloud benefits, a lot of cloud services that are there. You could say it's becoming serverless. It's becoming cloud native, for example. That's what re-architecting is about. But it's a big step. This is really a challenge for a lot of companies to move through the re-architecting phase. Repurchasing, this is a little bit smaller. It's basically transferring some maybe licensed applications that you run on-premise to the cloud through a software as a service, something like that. So now with a lot of cloud offerings, it becomes very easy to just buy software and don't even care about how it runs, where it runs, who's updating it. So repurchasing can, deliver a lot of value in that you don't have to spend time on that anymore. Retiring, when you move to the cloud, it's always good to think about the pieces of infrastructure applications that you don't really need anymore. So you can retire some of what you're running, and that's actually saving cost. And retaining, sometimes it doesn't make sense to move to the cloud, or there is a specific reason why you just want to keep things as they are. So that's the retaining. Sometimes you don't have to move. It's not always necessary.
All right. Well, thank you for the summary. I think from your description, and I mean, obviously many of our listeners are quite sort of technically savvy. The rehosting, retiring, repurchasing, and retaining are pretty obvious, but I want to dig a little bit deeper into replatforming and re-architecting. You already mentioned in your description right now that, or I hope I understood you correctly, that the replatforming part is more about the infrastructure underlying the application itself, whereas re-architecting is more about the application rather than the infrastructure. I guess infrastructure and application go hand in hand in the re-architecting case. Is that correct? Is that the key difference, or are there more?
Yeah, so that was a very crude distinction that I made, of course, because when you transfer your application from, let's say, an installed application on a bare metal machine on-premise, you have a very clear distinction between what the infrastructure is and what the application is, right? The infrastructure is the bare metal server with the operating system and, well, everything that's required to run something. And then you have your application that's actually installed on it. So there, the distinction can be quite clear. When you move to the cloud, the distinction between infrastructure and application becomes more vague when you move more cloud native. So this is when the distinction between replatforming or re-architecting can become a little bit fuzzy. So indeed, just now I made a hard distinction between infrastructure and app, but in practice, it's not always that easy. So when you're replatforming, you're really thinking about the generic platform that your application runs on, right? So you think about the type of network that you need, the type of firewall, load balancers, everything that supports all your applications or most of your applications. It is the whole platform that everything runs on. So the generic aspects of it. When we talk about re-architecting, this is much more thinking logically about what you want to achieve with your business, because infrastructure is supporting whatever you want to do on the cloud, but your application is actually delivering the business value there. Of course, this also differs from company to company, but in the generic case, I think this is true. So when you are re-architecting, you are rethinking the way you deliver value to your clients, for example, depending on the application that you run. Your clients can be internal teams, but also real external clients that are paying you for a service, right? So with re-architecting, you are really changing the way your application works. As I said, for example, splitting up a monolithic application into microservices. That's not just a technical encounter, right? That's really thinking about like in a logical way, how should our application work? Should we have a separate module for onboarding new clients, or should we have a separate module for clients wanting to do a specific action, or for logging in, or for extracting data from your service? This is really something that you have to involve both people from the business side as well as software developers in, because yeah, re-architecting is really rebuilding everything that you have in a way that would be more supportive to use, well, cloud benefits or any other things that can actually either save you money or create more revenue or whatever you want to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for this additional detail. And sort of you alluded to sort of you need to think about the business and what do you want to achieve. In general, these are relatively fundamental decisions. If you take them at scale, not sort of I'm dabbling a little bit, but they are relatively fundamental decisions. And fundamental decisions tend to have what I'd like to call second order effects. So what are the second order effects of a re-platforming or re-architecting decision? What does it mean for the business? And maybe let's start with sort of your domain of expertise, the security part of things, authentication, authorization. What changes in that domain when you go re-platform how your business runs or when you re-architect how your applications run?
Yeah. So indeed, there is a very complex dynamic always going on between the business and between engineering, because it really differs per company where these decisions come from, right? Sometimes they are made from a business point of view. Sometimes they are made by an engineering point of view. To actually move to the cloud or to become more cloud native or to use specific services. But yeah, you have to consider these second order effects in your organization and the teams that have to work with this. So for example, when you move from an on-premise data center to a globally available cloud provider, from a security point of view, you are changing what we call the attack surface. So your on-premise data center might be relatively small, innocuous data center that most people worldwide don't even know. When you move to Google Cloud or AWS or Microsoft Azure, then suddenly you are moving your applications to a location that have a very big target on their backs, right? I mean, everybody knows about these vendors and everybody would like to attack them because there is a lot of valuable information that you can get from there. And it's also, I mean, from a security point of view, if you want to make a name for yourself and you can get into AWS or Google Cloud or Microsoft Azure, that's a kind of a good marketing for yourself as well. So you have to think about that, right? Suddenly your tech service expands worldwide. But on the other side of the balance, you have this very big cloud vendor who have amazingly large teams working on the security of this platform, keeping this safe and making sure that all of this doesn't happen to you. And also they give you guarantees about what will happen or what can happen and what cannot happen. So yeah, you have to think about those effects from a security point of view, but maybe closer to home when you are transitioning to full cloud for your application. The teams internally have a different way of accessing everything. So where you had a team for your infrastructure in your data center previously, and a team that's working on the application and delivering the application to maybe the infrastructure team that installs the new software on the service, for example, now suddenly the software engineering team is probably doing all of this because they have to deploy directly to the cloud. There is the distinction, as I said, becomes more fuzzy between what's infrastructure and what is actually the software. So you get infrastructure as code that's also in GitHub repos, for example, that's updated by developers and then redeployed. So there is a really organizational shift there as well with responsibilities that go to the DevOps teams or the dev teams or depending on where you are on that transformation as well. And you have to think about who has access to what and if that's really necessary. So usually you have to reinvent the authentication and authorization of your systems as well. So yeah, these are quite fundamental and often overlooked. So companies want to migrate to the cloud, but they don't really think about these problems beforehand, which means that they either have to restrict a lot of access, which is frustrating development teams, and also not really increasing development velocity, or you are basically opening everything up to everybody, which will usually lead to happy developers because they are free to work on whatever they want to work on. But it's also really, really risky because you have to rethink what the risks are that you currently have. And what does it mean when the laptop of one of your developers gets compromised by malware, for example? Can that really bring your whole company to its knees? So these are very interesting challenges to think about. And I usually see that companies do this way too late. They start migrating, they have everything in the cloud, and then they start thinking about what does this mean for our security posture? And then they have to realize that it's completely different from what they were used to before. So your organization has to grow with these steps as well. If you migrate to the cloud, you have to think about what does this mean? And this also, it goes to what you're all about, right? All things ops. Suddenly, when you have a classic development team, you probably will move to a DevOps team because you want to integrate all of these disciplines within a team. And yeah, these are not easy things to do. So yeah, people should be mindful for that.
Let's dig deep. So thank you for this sort of summary. Let's dig deeper on the last thing you said a little bit on sort of the organizational change. My understanding of these interviews, talks that I have with customers and prospects and so on, is if you want to do this sort of for real, it's a little bit like the Al Bundy theme song. You can't do one without the other. You can't do sort of large scale re-architecting of how your sort of the application supporting your business runs without corresponding organizational change. And you also can't, sort of the flip side of this, you can't also just say, now we do, we want to be fancy, we do agile, we do DevOps, we do this and that, and still run your infrastructure as it used to be run with clear distinction between, ops and infrastructure and development. Would you agree, or is there more nuance to it?
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with that. Of course, it kind of depends on what the current situation is and how everybody works. But in general, I think that is fair. I think the correct way of thinking about this is, okay, you have a business and you want to achieve something as a business. You need to create business value. To create this business value, you need a technical platform or a solution or, some application or infrastructure. So then you think about, okay, what do we need to achieve our business value? Well, that can be in the cloud or on-premise or whatever. But you have to think about, okay, this is what we need to achieve our business value. And then you have to build an organization that supports running all of that in an efficient way. So those three things are very important to keep in mind. So basically people, process, and technology. You really have to synchronize that, how you do that. And you cannot radically transform one of them without transforming the other two as well. So yeah, they definitely go hand in hand.
All right. All right. So let's talk about one more second order effect, if you do remember me. Obviously, as somebody who professionally dabbles in monitoring, I have to ask, sort of, what are the effects of re-architecting things sort of from a monitoring and observability perspective?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point. I've also been thinking about this a little bit. I think in general, when you are re-architecting your application, this is also a very good opportunity to think about what the different... So let's say in the classic example where you have a monolithic application, you're splitting it up into microservices and you're thinking about functional components of your application, right? That's usually also the moment that you can think about what these functional components should be able to deliver and how you want to measure that. Because when you work on a monolith, everybody's working on the same big beast, so to speak. When you work on microservices or just services, you have, for example, a team that's responsible for, I don't know, if you run a web shop for checking out some products that you want to buy, and another team that's responsible for the account of a user. Now, suddenly, these two have dependencies on each other, and they are working independently of each other, which, well, is good, can provide some benefits, but they also rely on each other, and they have to, well, provide some kind of service level agreement or service level objectives of what they're doing. And this is actually a very good moment to think about, okay, how are we going to measure the performance of what we are building? And what do other teams or other functional components expect from us? So I think that's a very good moment to rethink that as well. I think there are many more opportunities to do monitoring and observability right when you think about these functional components and when you are going through that process. And also making sure that you do this from the get-go actually makes sure that you will deliver quality software down the line. If you forget about this and you try to do this after the fact, then you might actually realize that what you have built is not supportive for what you should deliver to the organization at all. And then you are back to square one. So yeah, I think this is actually a very good moment when you are going through these phases to rethink that as well and to make sure that you make these teams responsible for whatever they deliver. They have the monitoring and observability data of what they're building and can use that data to improve on their own functional components. So you make it smaller per team and you can actually measure more, I think. And well, more is not always better in this case. I mean, you can measure everything, but it should be workable data as well. But I think this is an opportunity for doing that right.
Yep. There's one thing that you mentioned, sort of think about this from the, like, kind of like security. Think of it from the beginning. And oftentimes, this is something that I encounter a lot when I talk to prospects and customers, is it's sort of the second order effects, security, observability, monitoring, and others are often sort of an afterthought. What tends to happen then is you have sort of, let's say, one set of tools, security, monitoring, whatever, that sort of are from, let's say, the old setup. And then you sort of migrate things and then you say, oh, we need to secure this or we need to observe this and monitor this. And let's quickly get a tool for that. So what you have now, you have like at least two sets of tools. And two sets of tools always means that people speak different languages, and that creates enormous friction. And fixing this after the fact and saying, okay, well, maybe we should try to consolidate on one and agree on one, is a pretty painful exercise. So I agree with what you said that, the earlier you think about it, the less painful it becomes to sort of establish a common ground so that everybody speaks the same language. That's my experience.
Yeah, definitely. So I This is always tricky because I can say to teams, like, you should have thought about this from the beginning. That would have made your life easier, or that would have increased velocity now. But yeah, what are you going to do? I mean, they are at a point now where they are facing this challenge, and how do you solve that? Yeah, I think it's always a pain that you have to go through, but it is worth it. And yeah, I do fully agree with you. Too many companies are still handling this as an afterthought after they've built something. And to some extent, I understand this, right? If you're a business leader or a product manager, you care about new features, delivering value. You have to outrun the competition with whatever you are doing, right? So I do get this. But delivering quality software is really important. And I think monitoring, observability, security are aspects of quality software. And also, I think in the world of software, we have to mature a little bit in this. I come from an aerospace engineering background, right? So I've been trained on how you design and engineer aircraft and spacecraft. And this is actually a very good example because it's really heavily regulated. You cannot just build an airplane and fly it with passengers on board for fun. No, you have to comply with all the regulations, all the safety stuff, which makes sense, right? It's very dangerous if you don't. With software, we don't have this approach at all. If I drive a car, I have to get it checked every couple of years to see whether it's still in order, whether it's still safe to drive.
Well, that's a European thing. If you see the cars here,
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. Like, I know that's a European thing. It's not like that globally, but I think it should be, though.
But for airplanes, it's a global thing.
Yeah, for airplanes. But for software, we don't really have this at all. I mean, everybody can write software for any purpose. And if it's popular, if it's functional, people will use it. And sometimes for very important things, we do have some regulation, right? If you are going to build a banking app, for example, there is regulation to that. But if you are dealing with web shops or whatever, there are no real regulations that you have to adhere to. I think we should work towards a software quality standard that's just like something that we all agree on, that distinguishes great quality software from poor quality software. And I think monitoring, observability, and security would be aspects of that. But currently, it is a relatively free market in that sense.
That is actually a very interesting point. And sort of the town where I used to live when I was still living in Germany, there's two large companies there. There's an automotive company and there's an aerospace defense company. You know, it's not hard to guess which two these are. Doesn't really matter. So, you know, in a neighborhood, chances are that you have sort of engineers from both of these companies working in your immediate neighborhood. And a good friend of mine is working for one of these aerospace companies. And when we talk about sort of what we do, and when we really, as Tribe 29, when we release a new version, new product, new features, you know, we're talking in cycles of months, maybe a year out. He says, well, we're planning to release in 2028. And sort of me coming from a software world, it's like, damn, that's long. But then I think what you said is there's just much, much more care necessarily given to these projects and to getting everything right and checking if it's right and checking it again and checking the check and so on in this sort of aerospace engineering world for good reasons. That is something that is very interesting. That's something that I sometimes also need to remind me of, that yes, speed is good, but when it becomes sort of breakneck speed, it might become make you pay down the road. So that's a very interesting aspect. And I don't know if there's a solution to it. Should it be more regulation? Maybe, or if it's just sort of on the sort of how we think about software development, how we train people in software development thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So also just to be clear, I'm not saying software development should be more like the aerospace industry. I mean, the things I worked on during my graduation, they might actually be used in actual aircraft by the time I retire. So I'm really not a proponent of that as well, especially not for software. I really like to keep the velocity. I think both worlds can actually learn from each other in that sense. But I think the software engineering world, I'm also not for regulation, but I am for making transparent what is quality and what is high quality and what is poor quality. I think that, that would be good for everybody. If we can agree on something that establishes quality software, and yeah, that we can all strive towards that. Because I think many companies think they build quality software, but they really don't, and they don't know that they don't build quality software. Mm. So if we can make that visible in some way, that would be great.
Yeah, that is an excellent point. And I think a better way to phrase it than I just did. So coming back to technology, whenever we say sort of let's re-architect something, most people sort of jump to the conclusion, oh, we should run it in Kubernetes. You disagree, right?
Yeah, I definitely disagree. I also know that this could be a controversial point. I've actually pitched this in the past week to some of my colleagues, and I noticed that some really agree and some really don't agree. So, well, it's nice that gives some food for a discussion. But yeah, in general, I see that everybody is moving to Kubernetes when they are re-architecting something. And I kind of see why that is. From an engineering point of view, it's very interesting. There's a lot of capabilities. And basically, you can do everything you want with Kubernetes. You can build the most amazing complex applications running in Kubernetes. But I think it is not a suitable platform for most applications. Kubernetes is so vast. It is so complex. It has so many things, so many buttons that you can push and knobs that you can twist. I know very, very, very few people who fully understand the implications of what they're doing on Kubernetes. And that is a real danger to me, especially with a security background. I don't think I know anyone who understands Kubernetes security really, really well. There probably are some people in the world who do understand this, but the fact that I don't know any is, I think, a sign that it's very complex. And in that sense, also quite risky to use. That's one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that it's just quite difficult and hard work to make something run on Kubernetes in the way you want it to run. And for some applications, I think it is a really good solution because you will need everything that Kubernetes has to offer. But I think these use cases are not as common as most people think. So I see a lot of companies with relatively easy or simple use cases that want to move to Kubernetes. And then they create a whole team of infrastructure engineers who are responsible for supporting Kubernetes, updating it, but also maintaining it, improving on it. And they may have 20 people on the payroll that they that are only focusing on their Kubernetes platform. And it's usually, not really necessary for the type of application that they build. Mm-hmm. So that is why I'm also very cautious when people say we have to move to Kubernetes. I think for most companies, there are other platforms that would be better for them.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I've heard that before. I've also heard, if we the sort of the straight line re-architect equals Kubernetes. So, but I tend to agree. I know Kubernetes more from a monitoring it perspective, and it's a beast. A lot of these things are very sort of different conceptually than sort of, we only need to wrap around our heads how to monitor these, but then sort of, running things is I assume if it's difficult to think about how do we actually want to monitor this, I also assume that it's not easy to run it properly. So
definitely, yeah. I actually remember having a conversation with a client that I used to consult for. It was a fintech company, and we had a leadership offsite session, and we were thinking about where is this company from an engineering point of view standing 5 years from now. And I was doing this together with some engineering manager, and we both had to write down our ideas and then share it with each other. And he said something in lines of 5 years from now, every workload is running on Kubernetes, many other things as well, but amongst that was that. I wrote down 5 years from now, nothing is running in Kubernetes anymore. So that's very interesting.
That was an uncomfortable silence after that.
Well, it leads to a very good discussion. So that's very nice.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. So for my final question, sort of this deep dive part, at least, I'd like to come back to your work in IT security, or sort of marry the two things, sort of IT security from technological aspect, but more from the organizational aspect. We had a conversation prior to this where you said sort of your goal really is, whenever we're talking about security, to make security an enabler rather than a blocker for DevOps teams and organizations. What are some things that an organization can do to make security less of sort of the annoying afterthought and rather sort of enable people to do good work?
Yeah, that's indeed something that I like to work on, these kinds of challenges, because very often you see that security is seen as a blocker in an organization. Everybody dislikes the security team because they are holding back development velocity, right? That's something that I often see. This comes back to what we talked about before, about, well, basically the quality aspects of building software. So, for example, when you move to a DevOps organization, I think the next step would and should be to build a DevSecOps organization. So security should be embedded as a quality aspect of your software and not necessarily a separate team or a gate that you have to pass when you build new software. That can be very frustrating for developers. And that usually makes security a blocker. And then software developers are going to think of ways of circumventing that, which leads to more risks and not less risks. So I usually try to embed security into the development teams, because when you train, for example, development teams about the most common security problems, the most common programming mistakes in the language that they are using, and you can do that in a playful manner. So, for example, doing some kind of hacking challenges with them where they can sit on the other side of the table for once.
You've hacked the box kind of things.
Yeah, exactly. Doing stuff like that with software developers and helping them hack their own software, that really makes them thinking about security in a way that makes it very nice, because now they don't feel like somebody's checking their work. They see how much fun it can be to look with a different set of eyes at your code, because it's like the optical illusion with a woman and a vase. Not sure if you know it, that you can only see one or the other, right? I think the same goes for looking at code. When you are writing code, you can either see the functional things that you're trying to build, so the value that you're creating, or you are looking at it with a different mindset, and you're trying to see the holes in the code and the things that can go wrong with it. But you can never do both at the same time. I cannot do that either. I can see one thing or the other. And I think it's very nice to help developers sit on the other side of the table a couple of times per year, for example, to look with a different perspective at their code. Like, how can I break this? How can this go wrong? That's very interesting. And it also helps them learn this in a playful manner. And that really helps to embed security in the DevOps team. So I think you should still have security specialists within your organization, but they should not be operationally involved in every commit that's being done by developers. They should be there to train the teams or to help with very complex problems. But I think the teams themselves, they should have this capability within the team, and that creates room for making baby steps in security. So don't install a new SOS tool that is going to give you 70,000 findings that you have to solve by the end of the quarter, right? That doesn't work. Start with making sure that every new commit by a developer adheres to a certain code quality standard. That's much more valuable. And that's making baby steps in the right direction. And that also makes it much more fun for developers to write better code. Because I think everybody is motivated to deliver higher quality software. That's not
I was about to say that.
Discussion. Yeah. So there is no discussion about that. It's really about the way that we do things that can be very blocking for some organizations. So that are some of the thoughts that I have about that.
All right. Yeah. So actually, this reminds me a lot about a conversation I had in one of the first episodes of this podcast with Jerry Bell, who's the CISO of IBM Cloud. And he says, in his experience, all teams can sort of benefit from more exposure to red teaming and see, because we had this discussion, and this was on the example of Log4j or Log4Shell, where what you said, it worked as intended. It sort of, from a functional perspective, what was built, it worked as it should. But yeah, it was never looked at until it was too late with these other eyes is, okay, what if I use it for a different purpose than intended? And I think these are the two perspectives that you mentioned, the vase and the woman. It's a very, very important thing. And I think also from our own experience as a software development company, sort of it teaching or training or experiencing sort of secure software development practices is something that is extremely valuable and sort of benefits sort of the organization, the teams, the people. Nobody gets dumber by doing that. Everybody delivers better work, and as you said, you know, everybody wants to deliver good work. There's nobody on the planet who says, well, I'll just deliver shitty work today. So
All right,
this is sort of it was the last question that I wanted to dive into deeper. Towards the end, we have a few of these rapid fire questions, which sort of considering sort of your background, I'd like to modify slightly and think of them sort of from a hacker's perspective, at least sort of the second and the third question. But how old were you when you started sort of dabbling with computers?
Yeah, I think I was quite young. I was actually, this is also important. I was born in 1990. I think I got my first computer when I was 5. So this was like 95. And okay, it was because my dad had his own company and they had a lot of computers and he could bring computers home. So that's why I had a relatively easy access in 1995 to a computer. So okay, yeah, it was quite young.
And how old were you when you broke your first computer? Five and a half.
Also 5? No, yeah, something like that. I was still 5. So I had to call my uncle a couple of times to help us fix the problems. And when I got older, I did this more and more, right? I mean, when you're tinkering around, you just break computers. And I had a neighbor who was a IT specialist, and he had to help me a couple of times as well. And preferably before my dad got home, so that I had all the problems fixed before he had to use the computer.
All right. So, and now sort of I want to take it a little left turn. How old were you when you broke the first computer that wasn't yours, sort of hacked one into dysfunction, basically?
That was probably, so that's hard to remember. I think 8 or 9 at a friend's place, like when I'm trying to show off some new things that I learned running some kind of script and then figuring out that it doesn't work as I expected on another computer, and then you break somebody else's computer.
So that was 8 or 9. That wasn't intentional, but let's say intentionally break it.
Intentionally, I was a very good young boy. I didn't intentionally break anything. No, I think this kind of stuff started to happen around 12 or 13 when you're getting online for the first couple of times and you're figuring out what you can do online and break somebody else's system. So then somebody built a website and then you try to break into that and kind of break it, delete the guest book, which was a thing back then. So I think it was 12 or 13 or something. Yeah.
Okay. So from a hacker's perspective, what are your thoughts on sort of open source versus closed source software?
I am more of a proponent of open source software, but there are many aspects to it. Open source can be dangerous because everybody can work on it. So there should be some quality checking of what's being done in an open source package, of course. But in a lot of cases, that's actually quite good. So I am an open source fan. I think if you deliver quality software and you are proud of the software that you deliver, you should also be proud of the source code and being able to show it to everybody to check it. And in that way, you can actually mitigate a lot of vulnerabilities as well. So I am a big fan of open source software versus closed source. Yeah.
Now, I'm starting to guess the answer to this one, but also again, from a hacker's perspective, what's your favorite target to go after? Linux, Mac, or Windows-based systems?
Well, I'm actually curious in that sense what you think the answer would be.
Well, I think, as you mentioned, you're a big fan of open source software and the sort of the incremental improvement. I think that sort of your least favorite would be Linux systems, although it could also be because it's the most challenging to go after. But I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, because I think it varies. So Mac is actually the least interesting for me to go after. So I am actually a Mac user and a Linux user. I don't use any Windows systems, but Windows is very interesting to go after because there are a lot of interesting vulnerabilities in Windows. A lot of applications run on Windows with vulnerabilities. So that's a very interesting target, but it also requires more learning because I'm not a Windows user myself. Linux actually is very interesting because a lot of online systems are based on Linux. So that makes Linux actually a very interesting target. Yes, it could be harder to break certain modules, but also it's more interesting because you can read the source code. So you can actually learn a lot by reading that code and
doing white
figure
box,
out.
Black box hacking.
Exactly. But Linux is the underlying operating system for a lot of online systems, which makes it a very interesting target. So I think in my years, I worked the most on getting into Linux systems, actually. Yeah.
Now, last question in this little sort of back and forth. What's the scariest thing that you have seen sort of from a security hacking perspective? If you can talk, the scariest thing you can talk about, let's put it this way.
Do you mean in like a vulnerability or?
Yes. Something that you say, oh, this is not good. Or the potential of this is really not good.
Yeah, so the bummer is that I can't really talk about what it actually concerns, but I have seen the actual source code of applications that are running very, very core IT systems for, the population. So that everybody uses and that everybody has to use and that everybody has to store personally identifiable information in. I've seen the source code of some of it, which was so bad that, yeah, basically the first hacker challenges that you learn when you are 13 years old and you want to learn how to hack a system, they are sufficient to get in and either extract data or delete data or fully take over a server. The code quality that I've seen in applications of that importance, that was, I think, the scariest thing that I've ever seen and never encountered in any commercial company. Yeah.
Okay. That doesn't seem encouraging, but yeah. I mean, this is why there's people like you who, you know, hopefully find these things quicker than the people with slightly darker hats.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun and I learned a lot. If you want to, you can sort of directly address the audience. Is there anything in particular that you're very interested in, you want people to know about, besides the fact that Xabia is hiring and you're always looking for talented people? Anything of that kind?
Yeah, so because, as I said in the beginning, Xabia is all about sharing knowledge. We are always looking for people who want to join us on meetups or other gatherings to share interesting stories from the work that you've done or the company that you work for. This can be anything from building a pretty awesome application to solve a business problem to the things that you encountered while migrating to the cloud, for example. I'm always looking for people who are very interested in sharing nice stories about this and join our meetups both in Europe as well as in the US. So if anybody listens is very interested in that, please reach out. And
What's the best way to reach out to you? Is it LinkedIn, email, Twitter, Reddit?
Yeah, I kind of shun most social media, but I do use LinkedIn because it's inevitable. So maybe relatively boring, but LinkedIn is the way to find me. Yeah.
All right, good. We'll add a link to your profile to the show notes so people can find you. Lawrence, this has been great fun. Thank you so much. We covered a lot of ground, a lot of cool topics, some scary ones. I'm looking forward to next time you're in Atlanta, grabbing a coffee or a beer together. That would be really cool.
That would definitely be cool. Thank you for having me on the podcast, and it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Things Ops podcast. If you liked this episode, leave us a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast player. This podcast has been brought to you by Tribe 29. the CheckMK company. For more resources, head over to checkmk.com/podcast. If you want to send us feedback or suggest a guest, please drop us an email at podcast@checkmk.com. Until next time, happy monitoring.